This is Helen Cannon with Petals in Prose, and today I'd like to read from a very fascinating book called How Plants Work by Linda Chucker Scott, the science behind the amazing things plants do. And it truly is an amazing book about our amazing plant kingdom. My first house was in Corvallis, Oregon, home of Oregon State University, where my husband and I were working on our PhD research in horticulture. Our tiny front yard had enough room for a single specimen tree, in this case, a lovely, bloodgood Japanese maple. We were eager to update the front entry and replace the 1930s era concrete steps with a basket weave brick entry and a wooden deck. The design perfectly showcased our maple. We were thrilled with the transformation. Well, until next year. Suddenly, our maple didn't grow so well. Many of the branches died. Finally, it was in such dire straits that we dug it up and replaced it with a much smaller tree, which thrived. But what happened to the first tree? I asked one of my favorite professors at Oregon State about the tree's sudden demise. Jim Green was our department's extension specialist and didn't teach any of my graduate classes, but he was knowledgeable, easygoing, and had a wicked sense of humor. The graduate students loved him. Imagine my shock, then, when he turned visibly angry as I explained our landscaping changes and subsequent tree death. "What in the world do you think would happen?" he snapped. "When you disturbed the 75% of the tree's root zone in the middle of the summer." Well, we hadn't even thought about that. We dug up the existing lawn, laid down the bricks and deck timbers. I remember silently cursing the roots as we dug, and they were probably cursing us back. I felt stupid, not just because I had irked Jim, but because I hadn't foreseen these consequences myself. After all, I was getting a PhD in horticultural plant physiology. In hindsight, I think this was a defining moment for me, though I didn't know it at the time. I do know that it was during this time that I became more curious as to how plants responded to different environmental stresses, besides dying, of course. Over 3 decades, I evolved from a laboratory plant physiologist studying how plants function and interact with their environment to an applied urban horticulturalist and finally to an extension specialist at Washington State University. Though my career continued to change, my interest in how plants work only became more engrossing. I combed through articles on soil science, arboriculture, environmental horticulture, and restoration ecology, as well as those of the more traditional botany and horticulture journals. While botany books describe leaves and roots in isolation from each other and therefore have chapters called the leaf or the root, physiology is the study of systems. It is impossible to explain the physiology of a leaf or a root because their functions are influenced by other plant parts. It would be like describing how a heart works without mentioning the lungs that provide the oxygen or the arteries and veins that deliver and return blood. Instead, plant physiology textbooks have chapters on photosynthesis, mineral uptake, and flowering. However, it can be difficult to make these conventional topics both accessible and interesting to the non-scientist. Current books on plant physiology are primarily focused on newer research at the molecular and genetic levels. The content is timely and important, but boy, does it turn off your young average gardener who probably sees no practical connection between gene regulation in corn and the corn growing in the backyard vegetable garden. What we gardeners want to know is how plants work so that we can have gardens and landscapes that are healthy, beautiful, and don't need constant additions of fertilizers and pesticides. So this book is structured a bit differently. Each chapter opens with a real-life situation, often something in my own garden that I invite you to explore with me. Then I integrate the science as needed to answer questions that gardeners invariably have. I've tried to include all the practical topics you would find in a textbook, with examples and illustrations to make the science useful and easily understandable. Now I'll skip to what seemed timely to me, his chapter on why leaves can turn red anytime, any place. I'm a lucky gardener because I live in a region with distinct seasons. I actually enjoy storing summer clothes and rediscovering what's in my wintry wardrobe. Likewise, my garden packs away its languid summer greens, replacing them with bold reds, oranges, and yellows. If you're the fanciful type, you may like the notion of Jack Frost painting the autumn leaves. And indeed, cooler night temperatures speed up autumn color transformation. But wait a minute. Some plants have leaves that turn red in midsummer, or some whose leaves are red when they're young and then turn green, and some whose leaves are always red. Why do leaves turn red anyway? It seems as though plants possess more pigments than an artist's palette. That's because light is one of the most important and reliable environmental signals plants receive. Pigments select and collect particular wavelengths of light for photosynthesis and other botanical business. The pigments that reflect and transmit most of the red, blue, and purple colors we see in leaves, flowers, and fruits are anthocyanins, a name that literally means flower pigment. Unlike chlorophyll and carotenoids, nested cosily in chloroplasts, anthocyanins are water-soluble mobile pigments that can scoot easily within and between cells and tissues. Anthocyanins are multipurpose molecules. Their mobility in water means they can be used as cellular transport systems. Sugars, metals, and other substances can be hooked onto anthocyanins and zipped off to other parts of the plant that need them. Anthocyanins are also a natural sunscreen. Under full sun conditions, they can protect chloroplasts from solar overload by siphoning off some of the incoming energy. They're also powerful antioxidants, meaning they can protect plant cells from all kinds of environmental stressors. This is why nutritionists recommend that we eat so many red and blue fruits and vegetables. These antioxidants are beneficial to us too. With the advantages that anthocyanins offer plants, the curious gardener might wonder why all leaves aren't red. To answer this, let's look at some tree cultivars that have been deliberately selected for their permanent red foliage. There are several flowering crabapples with various hues of red foliage available at most nurseries, and many of these have been grafted onto a green-leafed rootstock. If we were to study these leaves in the landscape, we'd come across several green-leaved suckers threatening to overtake the red-leaved scion. Clearly, the rootstock of these crabapples is more vigorous. It turns out that anthocyanins are expensive to manufacture. Their synthesis takes chemical energy that the plant could otherwise funnel into growth. Even worse, these pigments can interfere with photosynthesis, further reducing the plant's energy reserves. Okay, now it sounds as though I've just contradicted myself. How can anthocyanins interfere with photosynthesis if they're not in the chloroplast? Let's review what pigments do with light. Chlorophyll looks green because it absorbs red and blue wavelengths, reflecting and transmitting the green wavelengths to our eyes. The absorbed light is what's used for photosynthesis. Red anthocyanins reflect and transmit red light, while they absorb blue and green. The absorbed blue light doesn't do any work in the anthocyanin molecule. It's not making sugars or something else, but it's not available to the chloroplasts either. So red leaves aren't able to use all of the incoming blue light for photosynthesis. The leaves' ability to make sugars is stifled. Green leaves naturally have the advantage over red leaves in cranking out carbohydrates. In fact, research on red and green-leaved coleus has shown exactly that, and red-leaved cultivars grown in the shade tend to be more green than red. Tender emerging leaves are at the mercy of the often hostile world. Insects wait to feast on them. Sunlight can parboil them. Diseases riddle them until they resemble lacework. One of the ways some plants protect their new leaves with a handsy dose of anthocyanin. This temporary condition called juvenile reddening is usually most intense in leaves exposed to full sunlight. Part of that is because of the natural sunscreen function I mentioned, but there may be another benefit. Leaves are pretty darn tough when they're mature, but when they're young and expanding, they don't have the tough, waxy cuticles, expanding the rigid cell walls and other natural defenses that older leaves do. Not only does this make leaves easier to attack from the outside, but it also means that water loss is greater too. We can see this happening in the garden on a summer day. The newest stems and leaves on our plants wilt first because they can't control the evaporation through expanding surfaces. If water uptake from the roots doesn't keep up with demand, then these young leaves lose so much water that their tissues are killed. Usually this happens at the tips along the margins of the leaves, where you'll eventually see browning or necrosis as an indicator. Now consider some garden plants that show juvenile reddening, such as photinia and English ivy. The young expanding leaves rarely wilt, and I've never seen leaf browning from water loss in either plant. In this case, what the anthocyanins might be doing is holding water inside the leaves by adhesion. Remember, the general rule is water always moves to where water isn't. Because red leaves have anthocyanins swimming around in the cellular water, that means they have relatively less water than green leaves. It's harder for water to evaporate away from red tissues than from green ones. A final problem young leaves face is successfully reaching full size. During the brief window of time, the bonds between cell and wall fibers are loosened, allowing them to slip past one another. When leaves are expanding, they rely on the power of water or pressure to force cell wall expansion and reach mature size. If young leaves are not turgid enough, whether it's from too little water uptake or too much water loss, they won't reach maximum size. In fact, the presence of notably small leaves on evergreen trees and shrubs is a good indicator of drought stress. Not only can young red leaves retain their water in cellular lockdown, they also attract more water from adjacent tissues. Increasing the water content plumps up young leaves, creating turgor pressure needed for cell walls to slide past one another and guarantee maximum leaf size. Once the leaves have stopped expanding, the anthocyanins disappear and the red fades to green. So the book I'm reading from is fascinating, and it truly does tell us a lot about how plants work. The author is Linda Chucker Scott. I hope that you might be interested enough to look up this book. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.